Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and this is our annual special edition of the show brought to you from the Paul Foote Awards, which are happening around me as I speak. We're going to be talking to all the people who've been shortlisted for their brilliant works of investigative journalism over the last year. We'll be talking to the head of the judges, Padraig Reedy, and of course to the magazine's editor, Ian Hislop. So, without further ado, let's start our tour of the party and our tour of the shortlist, starting with Tom Kelly from the Daily Mail. Tom, good evening. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that's brought you to the Paul Foote Awards?
Well, it was an investigation into a gang of tax scammers in India. So they were people who were phoning up thousands of Britons every day and claiming that they were from HMRC and that the person they were calling owed money. And they managed to fleece thousands of pounds out of a huge range of people, ranging from university professors down to, you know, just pensioners and all sorts, by sort of terrifying them into believing that they owed money.
So I think lots of people know that these scams happen. Everyone knows to kind of be on their guard against them. But actually getting to the heart of a scamming operation sounds very difficult. How did you go about it?
Well, we had a lot of tips. The section of the paper called Money Mail had a lot of people emailing in about this had happened to them and writing in. And we managed to trace roughly where through the payments that we thought was a place in Ahmedabad in India. And from there, through a couple of contacts, we managed to work out who was involved. And then we set up a sort of a thing where we pretended that we wanted to go into business with them and that we'd be able to provide, like, personal details. So I said I work for like a credit reference agency, so I had lots of British people's national insurance numbers, dates of birth, all the things that would be, if you were a scammer, would be really useful if you're phoning up trying to convince people that you are really from HMRC. And so we said we're going to business, but first of all we want to see a demonstration, we want to see you get a demonstration of the rest of it. And it took quite a few meetings, they were a bit unsure, and then slowly we kind of got in there, and then eventually they sort of showed us how it works. Of course we were there with secret cameras and doing it. It was quite nerve-wracking, but yeah, we got it.
This is very famous five stuff. This is fantastic. Did the meetings take place in Britain or in India? Where were they?
No, they're all in India, yeah. So we went over, we sort of set up in advance that we were going to have a meeting, then we had to have three or four meetings. They were half excited, obviously, at the prospect of what, you know, we said we had, and half, obviously, sceptical, rightly so, but not quite sceptical enough, unfortunately, for them. So finally, it took about three or four meetings, and eventually they agreed to take us in and show us the stuff. But it was, even then, right till the end, it was nerve-wracking, and you've always been scared about being caught for the last minute, so, yeah.
Did you witness people being scammed in front of you from the other end of the process?
Yeah, well, we saw them phoning up and terrorising quite a lot of people. None of the people who were there quite got scammed, but then we had so many people who have been scammed in exactly the same way, and the process was so clear. They actually have a script they read through, and they have so if anyone raises a query at the other end, they have a way of sort of an answer to it, so they're very quick. And you know, anyone who's filled in a tax return or dealt with child, you know, tax credits, whatever, knows how easy it is to make a mistake in a tax form. So they play on that difficulty and that confusion. Yeah.
You must have made the newspaper's insurers very nervous with this kind of sting operation.
Yeah. When I got back, they did say, "You've got to be more careful next time, Kelly." Jesus, you know, they were certainly, some concerns raised, but luckily only retrospectively. I'm not sure, I didn't quite tell them exactly what was going to happen before I went, which is always the best way, I think, of getting away with stuff, yeah.
Good way of ensuring editorial support. So that must be very hard to take it to the next level, or to ensure that there are results that come out of this if you're dealing with not only another country but another continent. What's the after story of your story been?
Well, when we got back, there was before we ran it, obviously we told the Indian police what we were doing. They sat on it for 3 weeks. Only after we ran it did they actually go and arrest them. They finally caught them. There's now a legal case going on there, but the wheels just rode very slowly there. Better stuff, though, in Britain, that the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, said he'd take action as a couple of the ministers. And they have now. One of the things that the scammers did, which was very clever, they could mask phone numbers to make it look like they were calling from a genuine HMRC number, which obviously then a lot of people who would normally have been sceptical believe they were true because it looked like it was a real thing. So they now managed to block those numbers for outward calls. So that at least has cut, you know, a lot. And there's also, I mean, another thing we did was we afterwards, when we cut a lot of victims coming forward, we looked at a lot of people complained about the bank's response, and we did another sort of subsequent investigation showing that banks were still allowing people to pay to these fraudulent accounts even after they'd been warned by previous victims. So that's put more pressure on banks to actually take action. So it's there's some, you know, Indian police are doing things, but it is slow. But at least there's been, you know, some successes at home as well in trying to stop this or at least reduce it, I think.
Well, that is an extremely interesting story. Definitely takes the gong for most swashbuckling, I think, in this year's shortlist. So congratulations and thanks so much,
thanks,
Tom.
Thanks very much. Nice to meet you. All the best. Cheers.
Hi, I'm Phil Coleman. I'm chief reporter at NewsQuest Cumbria's Carlisle office in Cumbria. Work for two newspapers, the daily newspaper, The News and Star, and the Cumberland News, which is a weekly. My story is a rather strange tale about a psychiatrist who incredibly fooled the medical authorities in the United Kingdom for 22 years. Zolia Alemi, originally from Iran, studied in her early life in New Zealand, and whilst there she struggled academically, and eventually, after just a year of medical training, she dropped out. After that, she disappeared for 3 years, and eventually turned up in the United Kingdom, and astonishingly, in 1995, she found her way onto the General Medical Council's Register of Qualified Practitioners. Now, Zolia Alemi had an incredibly long career working for both private practice and the NHS. But in 2016, she got herself involved in a quite staggering fraud. She was running a dementia clinic in West Cumbria. One of her patients was an 84-year-old widow, a lady called Gillian Bellum. Gillian didn't have dementia, and Zolia Alemi, as her consultant psychiatrist, dismissed her from the service with a clean bill of mental health. And in the weeks and months following that happening, Alemi began to financially and emotionally groom this elderly woman, and very insidiously, very cleverly, very slowly took over this lady's finances. And she even went so far as to make an application to take out power of attorney on this lady. Now, it didn't stop there, because the coup de grace, the big goal that she had in mind, was to redraft this lady's will and to do so in her own and her family's benefit. So this lady was worth about £1.3 million, and under the terms of the redrafted fraudulent will, Zolia Alemi was due to inherit that entire amount. Now, all of that was on public record. That was the subject of a fraud trial. Alemi didn't give any evidence, but she was convicted on convincing evidence. And that, as far as the authorities were concerned, was the end of it. However, on reflection, as I wrote background pieces about this story, it struck me that it would be incredible, absolutely astonishing, if this woman had started her career in deception at such a pitch. She'd obviously deceived before, she'd lied before, and I was fascinated to know to what extent. So I did what I felt was the logical thing. I went all the way back to the beginning. I found out where she qualified, and my hunch was that there may be an issue, there may be something not quite right. I have to say, I was staggered when I got the confirmation that she never actually qualified, and yet she got away with it.
So how did you go about finding out information that is from decades ago now, yeah, and that, you know, is presumably quite tricky to find out, especially if you're crossing international boundaries?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll draw two distinctions here. In the United Kingdom, I feel we have a society, civil society, which is incredibly spun, incredibly filtered, and I would wager that there are far more people working in public relations in the United Kingdom than there are in journalism, what I call real journalism. However, in New Zealand, it seems that the culture there isn't quite so spun, isn't quite so tightly controlled. So I simply tracked down two people who I thought could take me to the heart of whether this woman was or was not genuine. The first was an official at the General Medical Council of New Zealand, who, having received my first inquiry by telephone, not by email, having received my first inquiry, went away, checked, and basically found that this lady wasn't on the register in New Zealand as having qualified. And he suggested I then take the inquiry further to the University of Auckland, where Alemi claimed, and this was there in black and white on the General Medical Council Register of Medical Practitioners, she claimed to have qualified at the University of Auckland. With help from George Symes, the guy who initially helped me at the General Medical Council, I got confirmation also from the University of Auckland that she'd actually dropped out. And to cut a very long story short, I eventually tracked down this lady's tutors, the people who were responsible for her academic well-being, and they told me the full astonishing truth that she was a struggler. She never did manage to achieve the academic excellence to qualify, and she was basically thrown off the course, the medical course, after 1 year. She did achieve a degree in human biology, but she never qualified as a doctor. Having got herself onto the medical register, which was the initial hurdle that she faced to become a bogus doctor, she then legitimately, and this has caused immense surprise amongst high-ranking medical professionals in this country, she legitimately got herself registered with the Royal College of Psychiatrists, which effectively means she became a consultant, and that means you get to work unsupervised. Now, it's accepted and widely understood in the medical profession that to become a consultant and get through those assessments is an incredibly demanding process. You're tested rigorously, you're supervised, you have to show that you know what you're doing. And she managed to do that. And on any reckoning, someone who isn't a qualified doctor having achieved that is quite astonishing. So on a personal level, she is a fascinating character, and I would absolutely love to interview her. But sadly, she's not available just now.
So you found all this out as the result of the fraud trial.
Indeed.
And did you find out further evidence of wrongdoing or other cases where this kind of thing had happened?
Well, I'll answer that question in two parts. The first thing that came out of this whole investigation was that in the early 1990s, there was a relaxed system in place for people being entered onto the medical register, the General Medical Council's Register of Practitioners. It was relaxed, presumably because there was a shortage of qualified doctors. And essentially what this was a system where people were taken on trust. Now, Alemi was clever enough to go to Pakistan, where she got clearly decent quality forgeries of a medical degree certificate, forgeries of letters of recommendation from a hospital, all of them fake, all of them completely bogus, and that opened the door to a lifetime of incredibly wealthy medical practice for this woman. Now, as a result of her having achieved that deception, the General Medical Council instigated checks on 3,100 Commonwealth doctors who, like Alemi, came into the country under those relaxed rules. And as recently as 2-3 weeks ago, they finished those checks and discovered, they tell me, that there were no more bogus doctors. However, the story doesn't end there, because there are non-Commonwealth foreign doctors who came to this country equally from countries that have a reputation for forgery and fraud. And the process now is, who do we check? How do we identify other fraudulent doctors? And I've had contact from quite a few senior medical people in the profession across the United Kingdom who have put names to me of people they feel are highly suspicious. But yes, there is more to find out, because this story, the tentacles of this story go far, they really do, and they go very deep.
Claire Newell, Investigations Editor, Daily Telegraph.
So, Claire, can you tell us about the story that's brought you here tonight?
Well, it was all about our fight against Philip Green, who had been accused by employees of sexual harassment and racism. And subsequently, following these accusations, he'd had to pay out millions of pounds to keep people quiet.
This must obviously have been a very legally tricky story for you to run. Can you tell us anything about the process of doing something where everything needs to be lawyered to within an inch of its life?
I think it is very difficult, actually. When you're speaking to sources, you're aware all the time about the risks they might be taking in speaking to you and telling their stories. And you have obligations to sources to make sure that you're going to protect them. And then, of course, when it comes to putting the allegations of someone like Philip Green, sometimes an injunction or an interim injunction follows quite swiftly, which can be a bit depressing. But then, of course, you have to fight it. And we did fight it, and I was really proud that the Telegraph decided to put the finances behind the investigation and make sure that we saw it through to the bitter end.
One thing that we're always very grateful for at Private Eye is that we've got a lawyer who tries to help us get stuff in rather than say, no, you've got to cut all of that out. Did you have a similar experience when you were trying to get this story through?
Yes, definitely. So I worked really closely with our head of legal, Rachel Walsh, and she was as dedicated to the story as I was, and she wanted it to be in the paper. And it's very important to be working closely with the editor and the head of news to make sure they're backing you all the way, because someone like Philip Green likes to get on the phone a lot and try to shut things down.
Was it a story that took an enormous amount of spadework before the first time you could print anything? Or was it one of those where you start running something and then you just sort of follow it through with lots more stories?
No, sadly, it was one of those stories where you work on it for many months. I probably worked on it for 6 months before I felt that we were in a position to be able to publish something. And then we put the allegations to him, and then he managed to shut us down temporarily. So it was 6 months of hard graft. Without a story to show for it.
That's especially interesting because also it's a story about non-disclosure agreements and people trying to shut things down, and then as soon as you approach the subject of the story, they try and get an injunction so that you can't write anything at all. This must be doubly frustrating.
Yes, but it also kind of makes the point, doesn't it? You know, when someone like Philip Green screams and shouts at people saying, "I'm going to bankrupt you, I'm going to shut the paper down," it kind of makes the point that he is a bit of a bully.
If he'd rolled over at the first sign and said, "Yeah, you're right, I feel terrible about this, I'm absolutely mortified," it would have made it somehow less impactful. So did he scream and shout at you personally?
No, I didn't speak to him directly, but he did really try to speak to everybody within the Telegraph to try to stop the investigation. And I think he used to refer to me as "that girl," so he didn't like the questions that I was asking. But it's kind of the job of a journalist, really, isn't it, to go around asking questions.
What next for this particular story?
I think we'll have to see what happens. So in America, he's been charged with groping a woman out there. And so there's a court hearing in a couple of weeks. So we'll have to see what comes from that. I think there's quite a lot of pressure in the UK, actually, for him to be stripped of his knighthood. So that will be quite interesting to see what happens politically.
Absolutely. Well, a fabulous story. And thank you so much for speaking to us tonight. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Dugan, and I'm a reporter for BuzzFeed News. For the last, nearly 2 years, I've been working on reports into the Ministry of Justice and their handling of legal aid, and essentially looking at how legal aid has been cut back and the effect that's having on the court. So there was a piece of legislation called LASPO in 2012, and what that did was take legal aid away from a lot of people. In most family law cases, lots of other areas like employment tribunals, but also less well known was the impact of changes around the same time to eligibility for criminal legal aid, which was actually resulting in people defending themselves in criminal cases without lawyers. And the knock-on effect to this has been all over the country, people having to represent themselves in matters that are so serious. And I guess a lot of people don't necessarily think of family court as having the same enormity as, for example, criminal cases. But if you're talking about never seeing your children again and not having a lawyer in order to fight that, this becomes obviously a really quite frightening experience for parents, and it's quite shocking that it's going on and it wasn't getting much scrutiny.
So, it sounds like a hugely significant story. At what point did you start covering it?
I covered it a little bit back when I was at The Independent several years ago, but I got my teeth into it properly about 2 years ago, once I was at BuzzFeed. And the thing that struck me about it was that although it was sort of generally accepted that these cuts had happened, people didn't necessarily realise the enormity of their impact. And there hadn't been many stories just telling the human story from court, so I was spending a lot of time in courts around the country trying to gather those examples. And again, the criminal aspect hadn't been covered. And I discovered there was a report with interviews with judges about people defending themselves in criminal cases. And the report released under FOI after a very long battle to me was six pages long, and it was called a summary. And I called up the MOJ press office and said, "Well, it's called a summary. I asked for the research. Are you sure this is the full research and there's not been any edits? Because this was meant to be interviews with judges and there's no quotes from the judges. There's nothing to suggest that this is really any kind of fulsome evidence of their views." And they said, "This is the full research. Any changes are just spelling and grammar." And I said, "Well, I don't believe you. I'm very sorry, but this is a substantial piece of work and I can't believe it's only six pages." They were very cross about this, suggested, you know, you shouldn't say that we were lying, sent follow-up emails saying you shouldn't say we were lying. The following week, I was leaked a copy of the full report. That was 36 pages long. And that report said that defendants were like rabbits in headlights. That was the exact quote from one of the judges. And it talked about how awful things were in court for people who didn't have lawyers facing criminal charges. Yeah, and then obviously at that point decided to publish some of the more choice words from the press office about me accusing them of lying.
So this now is becoming a different story where they're kind of trying to make it about you, and obviously you're just trying to cover the story. How did things develop from that point?
I mean, this kind of rumbled on, and I put in a subject access request to try and find out whether there had been to and fro on that six-page report. You know, I was trying to get to the bottom of that. What I got was a huge bundle of redacted documents and some instant message conversations saying, between what I assumed to be press officers at the Ministry of Justice, saying that I was a real bitch and a bit crazy, really. And so in the end, we decided that given that everything they'd sent us was redacted, pretty much, there was so little there, that we would publish those thoughts, because it didn't seem very seemly from civil servants who are meant to be politically impartial.
So I guess to cut to the next phase, what happened as a result of that coverage?
Because of them not releasing what appeared to be the full report, the Ministry of Justice maintains that the 36-pager was a draft. I should say that. That's their position. It was a draft report, and the final report was a 6-page summary, entitled Summary. Make of that what you will. So I took them to the Information Commissioner, and a criminal investigation was launched, but in the end, it was dropped. They found that there hadn't been a breach, specifically of FOI law. And I think part of that is, It's quite hard to argue. If they're going to turn around and say this was the final report, we decided to make it a summary, and that's what was there, and the earlier version is a draft, it's quite hard to come back. I don't have the internal documents. That's what the subject access request was sort of trying to achieve. But anyway, and the kind of the saga continues, because there has now been a review into LASPO and into the effects of this, and the government is hopefully making some changes to the means test, which is not very sexy, but the means test was changed so that, was introduced in Crown Court cases. And that meant that, whereas before you could automatically get a lawyer in Crown Court, now there's a threshold of income. And there are quite a few people that fall into this gap where they don't earn very much money, but they earn some, and they don't qualify for a legal aid defence.
And is there a prospect of that means test being altered or removed?
Yes, I believe so. They're certainly updating it. So that was the other aspect for all areas of law, was that the means test hadn't been updated since 2010. And so it didn't reflect the cost of living. I mean, for example, maybe in an employment tribunal case, you weren't going to meet that threshold to get legal aid, even though you were objectively, according to research by the Law Society, you were living at a poverty level.
This is Ian Birrell from the Mail on Sunday.
So, Ian, tell us a little bit about the story that's brought you here tonight.
It's a campaign, really, rather than a story, a series of stories about how particularly children, but also adults with autism and learning disabilities, have been taken from their families and their homes and locked up in very abusive detention. It's redolent of all the sort of Victorian stories of Bedlam, whereby these people who don't actually have mental illness are put in the worst possible places for them and sedated forcibly, held in solitary confinement, sometimes naked, with no facilities, fed on the floor like animals, sometimes fed through hatches. And it's like a little insight into how bad the psychiatric system can be. And to be honest, it's incredible these sorts of practices are going on in the 21st century.
How did it first come to your attention? When were you first made aware of this kind of thing?
Well, my own daughter has learning disabilities, so I actually knew about some of the issues for a long time, but I hadn't really understood the full horror of what was going on until I spoke to the father of a girl called Beth beginning in about September last year, and he told me about walking. He described it as like something out of The Silence of Lambs. You walk along this corridor, and there are these cells on either side full of children and hatches where they're fed through, and inside was his daughter. And everything about the care was making her autism worse, because you couldn't have a worse environment for a girl with autism. And when he told me about it, it was like I clicked at exactly what was happening. And then I began to speak to other parents and realized how prevalent this was and, to be honest, how horrific it was.
What kind of obstacles did you come up against when you were reporting this? I imagine this is a very, you know, this is a story that a lot of people would like you not to be writing.
There were some obstacles. I mean, it helped because of my own family situation. The families trusted me, and that was a big, big thing, because some of these people are legally silenced in one extra layer of obscenity. They put gagging orders on them so they can't talk about what's happening to their own children, and they're not allowed to see them sometimes. I mean, one father told me that he'd sent his son in for respite care for 3 days, and that was 3 years ago, and he hasn't seen him since then. There were problems when I was writing about the huge corporations behind it, because the private sector has muscled in on this. A lot of them are giant American companies or private equity firms, and they didn't take kindly to having this sort of abuse exposed, particularly when they're making tens of millions of pounds profits and paying minimum wage to people on the front line. So there were some toing and froing, shall we say, with some of the big private operators in particular. And there's a charity who run one particular centre who paid their boss £900,000 over 2 years. They didn't take kindly to my revealing what was going on in public. But in the main, it was more just trying to get the families to open up. And then it's always very hard to get stories about disabilities into the mainstream media. And I'm very grateful that papers picked up on this one. And then it's led now to something like 7 different inquiries. And that's been really good to see as well.
It's almost too shocking to believe when you first hear the details of this story. It is, as you say, it's Victorian. It's really horrifying to hear. Can you tell me a bit more about the editorial side of it and trying to, you know, get people interested in it and trying to keep them interested as well until these inquiries are going?
Well, I began actually doing columns in the iPaper. I do a weekly column, and my first three were there, which worked quite well because it allowed me to sort of gather some of the evidence and almost to explore the issues, and because I couldn't quite believe it was as bad as it is, because it is staggering and it is so inhumane and it's so barbaric, and so that helped. Then when I went to the Mail on Sunday editor, they were great and they just thought this was fantastic. And then I wrote the first piece, and it had an astonishingly powerful personal testimony by a mother who I'll never forget. She told me that her son was a teenage boy who liked being outdoors. He loved sport. He was a bit of a joker and he liked bad jokes like a lot of kids. And then she sought a little bit of help and he was put away. And the next time she saw him, he was drooling. He could barely speak. He put on weight. And she said that her life changed in that one instance and she knew she'd failed her son. And that really sort of got to me. And I think it got to the editors as well. They read this stuff and came back and said, let's go bigger on it, let's do more on it. And then they totally backed me on doing it week in, week out. And it also helped that the readers responded very well. I got a lot of emails, I still get them all the time now. And the papers flew online. Again, I think because they're so staggering. So there was one in Scotland of a boy who'd been held for 9 years in Carstairs, which is there, Broadmoor. And again, why is a kid with autism held in a place like that? And again, that took it flying. So it helped that the public reacted very well, the readers, because it is so inhumane and barbaric and abhorrent.
And I guess the most important question is there a prospect of these children being returned to their families?
I think certainly the fact that the BBC has done another great panorama, ITV has done documentaries, Victoria Derbyshire, BBC Breakfast, other papers has helped. I guess at the end of it, I feel slightly depressed because I think there is all this publicity. There will be some changes. I think Scotland probably will move a bit faster than England. But actually, Matt Hancock promised action, came to me, wanted to clear the decks before his failed leadership pitch, and then did nothing. And I fear that at the end of it, not very much will happen. So we'll wait and see, and there is some very good political work to push it, different committees looking at it, so hopefully there will be, and it'll speed things up, and it is at least in the discussion. But I guess I'm slightly pessimistic because we've known about this for 20 years. The experts have known this is wrong. They know it's happening. They pledge to get people out, but still it goes on.
I guess we'll have to wait and see what the extra attention yields. An incredibly important, moving story. Thank you very much, Ian.
Well, thank you also to Private Eye for recognising it, because it's the doyen of investigative journalism, so it's nice recognition.
I'm Richard Brooks from Private Eye.
Richard, you've been nominated for this award quite a few times now. What are you in for this year?
More desperate need for approval and approbation.
And what's the story?
Oh, the story.
Yeah.
The story is about the Tory party treasurer, who has a very murky financial background. His own finances, he's run away from a lot of bills, run away from a lot of creditors, run away from the tax man several times.
So this is Udi Scheleg, and we're talking as though I've never asked you about this before. We did actually do a full half an hour talking about him a couple of months ago. So you're being a lot more relaxed in the way you describe him than last time. I think you were very careful last time we talked about him in your language. But now, has something changed?
Well, Robin, our lawyer, isn't here. And also, just the evidence piles up. That's the thing. You know, you just get more and more and more. And everywhere you look, you realise that this is a bloke with... the skeletons tumble out of the financial closet. And now we're up to, you know, half a dozen of them. I think I'm feeling a bit more chilled out about it, really.
So just for anyone who hasn't heard that special episode that we did all about him, which is a fascinating listen and well worth checking out, the main aspect of this story that's really interesting is that he is the treasurer of the Conservative Party?
He is. He is the treasurer. He's the treasurer responsible for fundraising. So he's the one who's supposedly going round shaking the tin for the Tory party, and as we know, their tin is very empty at the moment. They could be getting more and more desperate for money. There may well be an election coming up. They've got a man whose chief connections are really with very dubious characters out in the former Soviet region, and who doesn't pay his tax, who wants people to, you know, contribute to British politics but runs away from his tax bills.
So this is quite an interesting example of how long it takes to get a story up and running, to keep it going, and then to keep going afterwards. Because we last spoke about Mr. Scheleg months ago, and you're still on the case, I would presume. Have you heard anything new or different in that time?
Yeah, in that time we found out quite a lot of new stuff. We found out that Mr. Scheleg has a special sweetheart arrangement with HM Revenue and Customs. Although he's sitting on millions of pounds of cash, his gallery, his art gallery called Halcyon Gallery in Bond Street, sitting on millions of pounds, it's been given a deal to pay it extra time to pay its tax by the taxman, which is bizarre, because if you ask anybody you know who's having a bit of a struggle having to pay their bill on the 1st of January, 31st of January or whatever, you know, they won't be able to ring up and say, sorry, could I just have a year or so? He seems to get that, and oddly enough, don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but he got that deal around the same time as he became a big figure in the political scene, when he started making big donations to the Tory party. So he's donating £2 million personally to the Tory party, the same time as the company he owns is not paying its tax bill when it should do.
And have you heard any further from his lawyers? Because this is, it's so nice doing a follow-up, I must say, to one of these. Because I think his lawyers had given you some answer, but it was a bit of a fob-off answer. Have they been any more forthcoming since we covered him last?
No, the only contact with his lawyer was when I got an explanation about this tax deal that was wrong. And I put it to them as wrong. And they said, oh, yes, sorry, we made a mistake. And I pointed out that was not the first time they'd done that. It was a kind of bit of a habit. And I got a letter from the lawyer with no threat of any legal action, just saying, I'm a lawyer. Please don't berate my client in this way. We're not, thankfully, being troubled too much by my learned friends.
You think there's more to come?
Oh, there is. You wait. Definitely. And it gets glitzier and tackier, which is what we want.
Looking forward to it immensely. Congratulations, Richard.
Thank you.
So, I'm here now with Padraig Reedy, who is the chief judge of the judges, the judge supremo. Good evening, Padraig.
Very important stress. In charge of all the judges, yes. Best judge. Not, maybe not best judge, but in charge judge.
So you have had the task of reading through the mammoth number of stories that have been submitted. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It's fascinating because we spend the week before the deadline panicking that no one is going to enter. And sitting there with five entries, two of whom are just personal vendettas against their neighbours, email exchanges, thinking no one is going to enter at all. And then suddenly, because we are dealing with the cream of British journalism, everything turns up on the last day. This year we had more than ever before. Again, we keep building more and more entries. Better range of entries than ever before. It's enormous hard work, but enormous fun, because you go through this, first of all, heartened that people are doing this at all. And secondly, to be very honest, there's a lot of stuff you've missed during the year. And you think, that had completely passed me by. But all this other stuff was happening because I was looking at what was happening with Brexit and the backstop or whatever. I completely missed this other brilliantly important story. But the fact that people are plugging away at these things and in the end getting results is really encouraging and heartening.
One thing that's really interesting to me is the genesis of all these stories. They all start with someone noticing something slightly out of kilter. So Ian Burrell's story started with his experience with his own daughter and talking to other parents who were in a similar situation. And every time it's just someone saying, oh, that can't be right. And they're either an expert in that field or they're relatively new to it in some cases. But there's always an initial moment of discovery.
It's that fascinating instinct the best investigative journalists have, just being able to look at things. And I think most of us, if something goes wrong in our day, we accept it. Or if we see something that looks odd, we just kind of go, that's odd. And the best journalists, of course, always look at things and go, that's odd. I wonder why that is. And that's why we get all these great stories, because people keep picking away at what might seem a small incident or what might seem one single incident, and keep on picking that thread and building on something, saying this is wrong, and then finding out why this is wrong, what this connects to, who's responsible ultimately is always the question, and how can this be done better.
We're going to go to Amelia Gentleman, last year's winner of the Paulford Award, in just a moment. But before that, here is Ian Hislop, the editor of Private Eye.
I'm really glad you're here and you're not watching the debate, which is going to be... God. It's going to be pretty riveting. No, it is very exciting. There's a possibility that one of our profession, one of us, a journalist, could become Prime Minister. It could be Boris. It could be Gove. I can't see any enthusiasm. There, you could argue that it hasn't been a great year for journalism, in that collectively we haven't prevented this happening. You might feel depressed by this, but the whole point of this event is to celebrate journalism, real journalism. Our very, very distinguished winner from last year, I would like Amelia, gentlemen, to say a few words about this year's list and winning last year. So, Amelia.
Thank you. I'm also thrilled to be here and not watching telly. I felt really proud to have won this prize last year for three reasons. Firstly, because of its association with the legendary Paul Foot, who remains such an inspiration for all of us and for all people who want to be investigative journalists or who feel like they might be able to call themselves investigative journalists. He is such a hero. Secondly, because of my own admiration for so many of the winners who've taken it home previously. But finally, because of my real profound love for Private Eye, which, as well as having a fearless and excellent investigative team, is the only publication that reliably makes me laugh out loud every fortnight. And somehow it makes everything feel a bit better in these really, really gloomy times. So I was thrilled also to be asked to be a judge. It turns out being a judge is quite a time-consuming process. And I have to say my heart slightly sank when I felt how heavy the material was that we had to read. But once I started reading it, I kind of sat on my bed for 2 days, ignored my family, didn't leave until I got through it all. And it was unexpectedly, incredibly cheerful making to read everything. And just to understand that even though this institution of journalism has been in crisis for as long as I've been a journalist and for as long as I can remember, people are getting on with it, shining a light into areas that powerful people would rather a light was not shone. And that's what really came out from all of the entries. The long-listed entries took on very, very difficult subjects. On the whole, entrants stepped off the news treadmill, didn't look at headline news, and it was a relief to discover that there's really almost nothing here about Brexit or about leadership challenges. And for the most part, they're focused with exposing forgotten and hidden issues. So we found out about complex bits of government policy on legal aid, explained in ways which were surprisingly gripping and revealing really profound and devastating human consequences. We found out about the really unattractive, harassing behaviour of political leaders and business tycoons, a lot about the funding of Aaron Banks and really, really impressive shoe leather journalism, finding sources and getting people ready to reveal very damaging emails. We learned a lot about corruption in student accommodation projects, about the women who are wrongly being accused after making rape allegations. We found out about corrupt solicitors, about corrupt doctors. We learned about racism in nightclubs' door policies, and we were taken to places that we don't normally get to see. So sweatshops in the Midlands where ill-paid workers are serving our passion for cheap fashion. And we went to Ahmedabad in India, into call centres overseen by bogus tax scammers who are successfully squeezing thousands of pounds out of vulnerable people in this country. Went to West Africa to hear about the little understood practice of breast ironing. And some of the entrants were very, very painful to read, particularly the investigation into how we continue to institutionalise people with autism and learning disabilities in really shockingly cruel ways. Some of it was really enraging to read as we understood the lengths to which government press officers would go to try and stifle legitimate and important investigative inquiries. Most of the stories had real impact. So policy got changed, criminals got prosecuted, questions have been asked in Parliament, important people have been made to squirm. And I often, increasingly often since I've been working in this industry for a long time, get emailed by students who ask, is it a wise decision to go into journalism? And I find that a very, very difficult question to answer. I'm often inclined to say, to point to the kind of failing business model and say, are you mad? But having read all of these entries, I kind of feel so inspired at what work is going on and very refreshed. And it reminded me why I really love my job, why I really love the industry, and how important it is that the profession is somehow managing and must continue to manage to survive.
The winner of the Bulford Award tonight is Emily Dugan, BuzzFeed UK!
Emily, huge congratulations on just winning the Bulford Award.
Thank you very much. I'm very honoured. I was not expecting that at all, so thank you.
Do you think that will add a little bit of impetus? Hopefully, you know, make the bosses at BuzzFeed pay even more attention to the story.
Well, they've paid a lot of attention to this story all along. They've been fantastic. And, it's not the sexiest topic, but it has such a huge importance to people's access to justice in this country. So, but I just wanted to thank my editors, Stuart Miller, who's now editor of BuzzFeed, and Janine Gibson, who was editing at the time as well. Stuart was obviously my news editor all the way through this. They showed faith in a subject that wasn't particularly... It's not the sexiest thing. It's certainly not, obviously viral. But they showed faith and let me carry on digging on it, and I'm very grateful for that.
Ian, another good night for investigative journalism.
Yes, it was incredibly cheering. Unanimous overall winner, who
had the great distinction of being described as crazy by government spin doctors, and anybody who's described as crazy, yep, good. She made a lovely speech in which she said they'd also described her as a bitch, so you thought, oh, come on, let's give her the award. It's got to be her.
It is amazing just talking to these people about how long they've spent on each of these stories. Years of work going into sometimes a single piece. That's the most amazing thing. And sometimes, of course, there are stories which haven't seen the light of day yet even because the lawyers have got in the way.
Yes, I mean, it is, you know, as we always say, investigative journalism is time-consuming, it's expensive, and it may come to nothing. But when it works, I mean, the effect of half of these things, you know, the number of inquiries, the number of people banged up, brought to justice, made to confess or turn their policy around is fantastic. And, you know, you get into a habit of thinking, oh, well, we bang away but nothing happens. Yeah, stuff does happen. It's really pleasing.
One thing I didn't know is that Richard Brooks, another of the people on the shortlist, was recruited by Paul, you said.
Yes, Richard Brooks used to have a perfectly sensible job as a senior tax officer, and Paul basically, in a very sort of Darth Vader way, drew him over to the dark side, and he became a journalist, and became a very, very good journalist. And the Eyes benefited hugely by having someone who is financially literate, knows how the civil service in all its echelons and permutations works. But also, I mean, and he is the first to say this, learnt from Paul how to write accessible prose that people find interesting.
And that's another thing about these awards. All of the stories are told in such a riveting way that, you know, half of the interestingness is actually in how the story was got in the first place by these very dedicated people.
Yeah, well, I mean, journalism, I mean, you know, it may not be an art, but it's certainly a craft. And you do get good at it, and there are people who are very good at doing it. And we saw a lot of them tonight. And it's not an accident. You don't just say, well, I wonder if I put a lot of graphs in and a lot of stats, do you think people will read it? No, they won't. Can you tell me a story about some people who this story influenced and what happened to those people? And then you've got people's interest.
That seems to be something that Paul Foote himself really specialised in.
Yes, I mean, Paul, you know, he was populist in the best sense of it and tabloid in the best sense of it. He worked for the Mirror as well as for, you know, everybody else in town. But and that's what tabloid meant then. It meant making it accessible and interesting. It didn't mean making it not true and entirely sort of wrong. It just meant saying, look, this is what's happening. It seems very complex, but, you know, like most human behaviour, in the end it isn't. He's taking the money or he's grabbing the girl. You know, there are a lot of those stories tonight. Or the government is saying, we won't spend any money at all on something that matters. You know, Ian Birrell's story, you know, and he's personally involved, but it's still moving. You know, and the treatment of autistic children, you think, oh, God, if there isn't money for this, what is there money for? And he told that beautifully.
So the next issue of the magazine is the 1500th, which is an enormous milestone.
Yes, it's 1,500 issues, which is probably a forest, at least, of stuff. But it is a milestone. We're still going. And, you know, judging by the reaction tonight, some people are still grateful we're still going. So 1500, we will be there. We'll be looking back at our past. We'll be looking forward to our future. And we'll be trying not to be depressed about what's coming up next.
So that's it for this episode of Page 94. And that's it from the Paul Foote Awards for this year. Another wonderful year of investigative journalists slowly and diligently chipping away at stories and doing their best to make the world a better place. We'll be back again in a fortnight with a 1500th issue anniversary special. We'll see you for that. Thanks so much for listening, and good night.